Hey, it's Tom here, and welcome back to another episode of the Investing with Tom podcast. Now, this was a really cool episode. I got the chance to speak to Matt Peterson, who runs Peterson Capital Management. Matt has been running basically a hedge fund for about the last decade and has compounded capital for his investors at close to 20% per year, about 19.4% per year, I believe. So we covered really a lot of ground in this episode. At his core, Matt is a value investor. He runs a fairly concentrated portfolio, typically holding around 10 stocks kind of in the fund. He does extremely deep research on every company that he owns. If you want to see an example of that, I'd recommend looking up Matthew Peterson Daily Journal, and you'll see some of the really in-depth work that Matt did on that particular company. So it was a fascinating conversation. I mean, outside of the core value philosophy that Matt has, he also employs the use of options in terms of both entering and exiting a position in order to crank up his rate of return as well. So we covered kind of the core philosophy. We covered put options and call options. And we also had a conversation about some of the individual companies that Matt owns that a lot of people are interested in at the moment as well. So those include companies like the Daily Journal Corporation, like Seritage Growth Properties, and sort of the Tencent trio, so Tencent, Naspers, and Prosus. So was a really fun conversation. Just a quick reminder that there is also a video version of this podcast now available on YouTube if you'd prefer to watch the video version. So just look up the Investing with Tom podcast on YouTube and you will be able to track that one down. But without further ado, let's roll the episode and I hope you enjoy. Matt Peterson, I am excited to have you on the podcast. We were just chatting before this about how sort of the intersection between the value investing community and the internet is kind of a strange place. We get to connect with lots of people that we maybe never expected to. I've been, like I said before this, following you from a distance for probably 18 months to 2 years at this point after first seeing you do some really deep and really interesting work on DJ Co., Daily Journal Corporation, which is one of the more popular annual meetings, I think, going around, but probably has about the lowest kind of proportion of people in the audience that actually own the stock. So that's kind of an interesting situation to follow along with. So I'm excited to have you on the podcast. How are you doing?
Tom, I'm doing well. It's a real pleasure to be here. I've also seen several of your episodes over the years, and it's an honor. I've seen your subscriber base grow significantly, so congratulations on that.
Yeah, appreciate it. Well, maybe for those that haven't come across you before, like I say, I first came across you from your Daily Journal Corp work and some of the annual meeting recordings and things that you've put out on YouTube, which is fascinating. But maybe tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into investing and discovering value investing and getting started kind of in money management.
Yeah, sure. And that's a very fair question. I've been passionate about finance and investing in business and math since a very young age. And I had a pretty entrepreneurial spirit growing up, and ended up studying economics and math at a small liberal arts school that most people haven't heard of called the University of Puget Sound, which is in the Pacific Northwest. And from there, headed out to Wall Street. I had a small stint over in Beijing before that, but I headed out to Wall Street in my early 20s and landed a job consulting for Goldman Sachs. And I was doing risk management work at Goldman for a number of years, I think about 7 years in total. Basically market risk management, credit risk management. And there was a lot of activities in that space. I spent a couple of years during that time working in London, where we were building out a credit risk calculator. I was earning my CFA designation at the time, and I was really putting the building blocks in place so that I could be running my own firm and fund. So that was really always the plan. And, I think my first Berkshire meeting was back in 2004, and I'd followed Buffett before that. So, I had a value bent to me from a very, very early age, and And so establishing the fund to me was a natural step. And we started 10 years ago now. We started very small, and we still run a modest sized fund. We launched though with $125,000 under management, and we've been growing steadily since then. So now we're 10 years in, we have a nice track record and a great portfolio.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, I have had a look at some of your annual letters that you sent through before this, and the track record is certainly impressive, and the fund has grown in size. And I think you have one of the more interesting kind of, I guess, what you call structured value approaches to investing. This sort of, as I understand it, the core value investing philosophy, reasonably concentrated, long only, at least as I understand it. But then you also have sort of this options component to it as well, in terms of trying to reduce cost basis and some interesting things. I guess I'm certainly keen to get into the options discussion, and I've collected a few questions for this episode, and quite a few of them are on that topic. But maybe before we get into that side of the discussion, do you want to talk us through how you think about structuring the core holdings in the portfolio? You know, what are you looking for in a business? How do you think about diversification versus concentration and kind of building a portfolio in the first place?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think your assessment there is very accurate. We do use this option overlay, the structured value process, as I refer to it. But the core essence of the portfolio, the ethos, is really this fundamental value-based portfolio. And so, you know, when we're looking for opportunities that are, I guess, have sufficient potential to belong in our portfolio, we're really sort of looking at three main aspects. We're really looking for the very best business models in the world. We're looking for the very best management teams. We're also looking for very deep value. And if we can find a scenario where we encounter a great business model run by great people that has a very cheap or reasonable price, I find it very hard to go wrong, because these management teams can help navigate and deploy the future cash flows of the business. And it's a really nice sort of Fisher type compounder that you can get into in that space. And so that, you know, fundamentally, we're looking for those characteristics around the business. The value space is going to be your standard value metrics. I mean, the ways that, you would analyze the financial statements and look at various aspects of the business. We're looking for a cheap company that's selling for less than the intrinsic value of the firm. We're looking for something that's growing. We're looking for great business models, and we're looking for great management teams.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. And as I understand it, you run roughly around a 10-stock portfolio. How do you think about concentrating on your best ideas versus trying to maybe smooth out the ride for your investors, I guess?
Yeah, no, it's a great, great question and observation. We run a very concentrated portfolio. We may have 10 to 15 securities. Some of them may be smaller. And, you know, our core investments are oftentimes 10 or 12% of the portfolio. So we do have a very concentrated portfolio. I actually spoke about this at a conference led by Guy Spier out in Switzerland about 6 years ago. And I did a little analysis, and it was based on the Kelly criterion. And actually, if I take one step back, I'll share with you, when I think about sort of concentration versus diversification, a few things come to mind. I lived in LA for 10 years, and there's a group there called the 10K Club. And it's not a running club. This is a investment research club with a bunch of very bright individuals. And a bunch of years ago, we sat down to talk about capital allocation practices at our firms, and everybody sort of went around the room and explained how they allocate capital. We were looking for objective opportunities, and I discovered that there was a lot of subjective analysis going into everyone's capital allocation strategy. And so I sort of went on this mission to figure out the most objective way possible. And the Kelly criterion sort of offers this. I'm sure a lot of your viewers will be familiar. what the challenge with the Kelly criterion basically says, if you know the outcome of a potential situation, you know, if you know the probability of a positive outcome, and then you know the outcome if you're correct, and then you know the probability of a negative outcome, and you know the outcome if you're wrong, and you have a fixed pool of capital, you can objectively identify the exact precise amount you should allocate to that particular opportunity. But the problem with that is we don't know the probability. In fact, so this works really well in blackjack, you know, where sort of there's a lot of modeling used and in things where there's fixed probabilities, but we don't actually know the probability of being right. And we also don't know the outcome when we're right, or the probability of wrong, or the outcome when we're wrong. So what I did, I guess maybe 8 years ago now, is I just opened up Excel, because Kelly was doing this with punch cards and things with like really low computing power. And sort of in an afternoon, I just solved for all of the probabilities. And I looked at what you would allocate with very wide parameters. And when I looked at that sort of matrix that was created, it was very obvious that, you know, the Kelly optimal strategy was to allocate basically between 10 and 50% of your portfolio to every single one of these potential opportunities that would reasonably fit in this category. So that's a very interesting exercise to go through, because it becomes very clear it has nothing to do with volatility. You're going to have to accept volatility, and you don't need to go right up to the edge of Kelly, but to really solve for all of these potential probabilities and see that the outcome is to allocate between 10 and 50% of your portfolio to an opportunity is quite profound. So I put together this presentation on that and spoke about it in Switzerland. I think I called it diversification versus diversification, because what happens is if you start introducing your 25th best idea, you're actually, the idea is probably correlated with another idea. So you're not really getting much risk mitigation, but you are most likely introducing lower ROEs, a worse business model, a lower probability of success. So you're going to get much more average returns as you start to introduce more and more positions in your portfolio without actually reducing your risk. And so that's the key message. And you don't need to be necessarily precise with Kelly, but you just need to understand that if you're running a portfolio and you have 50 positions or even 25 positions, you probably have way too many, and you'd do way better off if you could just cut those holdings in half. You might have slightly more volatile returns, but the returns will be steeper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess at some point you sort of just become the index, don't you? If you keep adding too many positions.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah. And I guess one of the things that I'm interested to speak with you about, because this is, I guess, something you might have to consider, that me as an individual investor just looking after my own money, it doesn't even kind of flow through my head at any point. But can you talk a little bit to maybe having, I guess, the right investor base, or having kind of the right people in the fund to be able to kind of stomach that volatility?
Yeah, absolutely. It's an interesting dynamic. And for anybody who's managed money professionally, you quickly realize there are great partners and there are terrible partners. And it's really important to get that right at the beginning. So I actually am very transparent and direct about the level of volatility. I mean, we've had many years where we have kind of 30%, even 40% returns. We have, you know, 3 years, I think, where we're negative, and two of them are like negative 25%. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't faze me. This is sort of like, I think you mentioned Daily Journal once already. I think since we've owned it, it's gone from 200 to 400 to 200 twice. And it's worth a whole lot more. So it doesn't concern me whatsoever. We're truly business owners, but we really need to have partners that understand that. Otherwise, you start getting your LP base panicking. And that isn't helpful for anybody. It's sort of like, if we're, you know, serving some Chinese food in a restaurant and, we might have the best, filet mignon, but if somebody shows up and wants Chinese food, we can't be serving them filet mignon. So we need to cater. We need to attract the right partners, for what we're trying to do. And, we have a, we accept volatility, as a, and by accepting that volatility, it allows us to concentrate our portfolio and have, greater long-term results.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like it. And presumably that sort of, having that right investor base becomes even more important in situations like March, April, 2020. Can you talk through what that experience was like for the fund?
Absolutely. I can address a few things with that. A lot of people ask in a interesting sort of way. People often ask about like checklists and these things. And of course, you know, everybody uses these kind of tools. It's the smart way to manage money. And I'll share with you something that was very helpful. And I think people maybe don't do as often as they should is about in probably 2018, I sat down and things were going well and everything was smooth. And I thought, you know, we need a crisis management checklist. We have all these checklists for how to operate when things are going, really well and we're looking to allocate capital. But what happens when, there's a real crisis? And, you know, a lot of people don't share the items on their checklist because they're highly personal. And I think a lot of times if you read the checklist, you'll be surprised at the items you'd see. But I'm happy to share with you, you know, some of the things that people forget to do is like eat three meals a day and go and get their workout in, because you just have to keep your head focused, and you need to be able to think rationally when everyone else is acting irrationally. So having that crisis management checklist was really powerful in that time period. And I was following it very carefully. I have rules in there where I'm not going to liquidate a position until I talk to three independent portfolio managers about that holding, express my thesis. And so I'm trying to give myself reasons to not sell, because most likely I shouldn't be. So there's that aspect of it. So that's more of a personal aspect. But you know, I was very pleased with the LP response. So I have spent, at that point, maybe 9 years sort of training what I considered training my LPs, you know, in my letters and things, sort of expressing that, you know, times are good, but they can be rough, talking a lot about volatility. And surprisingly, we had no immediate redemptions. We had one LP who was in a bit of a bind with his child was stuck abroad. We quickly got some cash to them so that they could just satisfy what they needed to do. But it was just a very personal matter for them. So that was very, it was actually sort of a rewarding time for me to see that my LPs were steadfast. And we actually had some inflows of capital. I spent a good part of March and April, actually on March, around March 25th, I sent the first memo to my partners outside of our sort of standard quarterly reports. So in almost 10 years, and I basically explained that this is the time to be putting capital to work. And this is the opportunity. This is one of the few opportunities of your lifetime. And if you miss this opportunity, you'll be looking back and regretting it. And I think that was really beneficial. We had inflows of capital. I had a lot of meetings that were set up, and I stopped using scheduled meetings, and I just started calling people that had been in my network for a while. And people were really interested to hear what I had to say. So it was but it's not comfortable. So don't get me wrong. It's very, even as professional money managers, I think people get the impression that, you know, we're supposed to be even keeled and our emotions don't work the same as everyone else. And that's just not the case. We feel just as uncomfortable. We have the same biology. Amygdala is like overriding our prefrontal cortex. It's hard to think straight, right? Everything's on fire. You think, our firm needs to survive. It's painful. But if you have sort of a checklist and you can understand, this is actually the time that we've been waiting for to deploy capital, review your thesis on all of the items on your watch list. Let's put money to work, try to bring in capital. It can become a very good time. And I think we handled the crisis very well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, couldn't agree more. I think I really like the idea of making a crisis plan in the good times. Unfortunately, people often do that the other way around. I think it's a very Berkshire-esque way of looking at the investment world, I think, where I think Buffett has described himself in the past as kind of chief mitigation officer at Berkshire. And he's talking about Berkshire basically needs to be a financial fortress that can survive anything. And he's always trying to be hyper-rational. Like even when we were going through a pandemic and, you know, people were criticizing Buffett for maybe not deploying more capital than he did, you know, through the depths of that time, he was saying, just because we're going through a pandemic doesn't mean that there's not going to be an earthquake this year that the insurance businesses might have to account for. Yeah. So having a clear head and thinking through that, I think is it's a good way to go. And I also sort of like the idea of having someone to talk to and I guess when you're sort of talking through ideas or potentially if you're considering buying or selling an investment with, if you're discussing that with other money managers, it again just kind of makes you talk out loud and just get these thoughts clear in your head. I actually find that quite helpful making YouTube videos of all things. You don't kind of quite know whether you truly understand something until you start explaining it to a camera.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment.
Yeah. Let's maybe talk about options. Did you want to dive into sort of your structured value strategy and what you do there?
Yeah, sure. Where to begin? Why don't I start at the beginning and move quickly? And then you can direct the conversation to whatever questions that have come your way. So what we're going to talk about now, this what I've called structured value, is something I have been pursuing and implementing in my own portfolio since about 2005. So when I was doing some work out at Goldman, I was helping write these risk management documents for all these different product lines, and I had to be working with a lot of the different trading desks, and I realized that there were these different products and they were sort of offsetting. These were prop desks at the time and they were offsetting exposures and things. And it became really clear to me that most people would use puts as a tool for protection, and we could actually use puts as a tool to enter into an equity holding and get paid for that position. And so I started with that really simple idea, and it has been extremely advantageous. I'm almost surprised that it still exists and that it's still possible, but there's a lot of ways to make money, and this is a really opportunistic way to go into an equity position. So I'd start from the beginning. So let's say we identify a position that we'd like to own, and maybe the company is selling for 100 and we think it's worth $200 a share. Or better, maybe it was selling for 200 and it fell down to 100. And we know that the intrinsic value is $200 a share. At that point, when we decide that we want to buy something that's 50% off its intrinsic value, instead of just using a market or limit order in the New York Stock Exchange, like most investors would do, we go to the Chicago Board of Exchange and we write a cash secured put contract. What that does is allows us to buy the security for below the retail prices. So what happens is we sell a put contract, we write a put contract, a counterparty buys that from us, and they pay us some amount of premium for our commitment to buy their shares for a fixed price at some point in the future. So if we just, you know, this is a hypothetical scenario. So let's go out 12 months. We have 1 year. Maybe we get paid $25 for a commitment to buy this stock for $100. And so what that means is we then take in their $25 and we hold our $75. And that basically gives us the $100 to buy their shares. And we wait a year. And at the end of the year, at the expiration date of this contract, there's a binomial outcome. Either the shares are, the stock price is above 100, which means we don't, they don't put the shares to us. The contract is over. We keep their premium and we had our separate ways. In that scenario, we've made $25 on our $75 in collateral, which is a really astonishing 33% return. Yeah. We didn't even own the stock. Alternatively, if the shares are below 100, we are then put the shares by the counterpart. We've committed to buy them for 100. If they're selling in the market for 90, they put them into our portfolio and we buy them. But it's only cost us a net cash outflow of 75. So we've found a way into the position for $75 a share. And then just like, you know, most of the value funds around, we then become very patient and long-term holders of security. And this is really just a tool to building into our position. It lowers our denominator, which increases our IRR. And so instead of paying 100 when we thought there was a good opportunity, we found a way to basically move in for net cash outflow of 75. And, you know, in a year or a few years, when the shares maybe appreciate to the $200 intrinsic value, we're then able to sell. And if we want to go full cycle, if we decided to sell at that point, we'd use a covered call to sell. And so we'd get paid once again. And maybe at that point, we'd get paid. I'm just making kind of trying to make some simple math. Maybe we'd get paid $25 again. And now we receive a $225. We receive, you know, we're selling for $200 with a covered call. Our strike is 200. We pick up 25 in premium, which means our net inflow is 200 that they buy it for plus the 25 that we receive in premium. And so what does that mean? That means instead of buying it for 100 and then selling it for 200 and making 100% return over, let's say, a 3 year period, we instead buy for net cash outflow of 75 and then we sell for 225. And so that gives us a 200% return. So instead of 100% return, we now have a 200% return, and it's really that simple, and that's the basics of what we do. I'm happy to now we can maybe go into some detail. I'm sure you have questions on it.
Yeah, it's a fascinating approach, and I was re-listening to a podcast you did with Toby Carlisle yesterday, and there's a lot of nuance, I guess, with I guess how volatile stocks need to be for some of these numbers to make sense, and also some interesting kind of tax situations and yes, some other stuff. I think you mentioned briefly there, I think you initially said, you know, the stock's trading at 100, we think intrinsic value is 200. And then you said actually even better, if it was 200, we think it's worth 200, but it's suddenly gone down to 100. Is that even better just because of the volatility, and presumably you get paid more for the put options you're writing?
That's exactly right, Tom. So the, you know, a lot of these are priced with Black-Scholes models. One of the factors being Vega, the volatility of the underlying security. So if something's more volatile, the premiums are higher. There seemingly is more uncertainty in the marketplace. And so if there's a position that happens to be volatile, it can be volatile because, you know, is in academia, volatility is synonymous with risk, but it doesn't actually have to be that way in practice. It could be that there's uncertainty, or they're looking for some price discovery, or maybe there's multiple outcomes, and it's going to lead to different prices of the different valuations and prices for the equity in the future. So there's different reasons for volatility, and if there is a If there's a known reason for the volatility, and then you're getting paid because something is volatile, that becomes very attractive. So the price of the premiums are a function of things like time and interest rates and volatility, et cetera. So when vol is high, you get paid more, and it's localized vol. So people look at the vol on the S&P 500 as being the VIX. So they call it the fear index. When people are fearful, the VIX is higher. And when people are less fearful, the VIX is lower. So when you're looking at individual securities, it's the same thing, but it's localized vol. So if there's a security that for market reasons or some event occurs and the price falls, you can get very high premiums on that security. And if you're comfortable with the valuation, it can become a really attractive situation.
Mm-hmm. And are there situations where the volatility is just not significant enough to warrant even doing this strategy, or presumably not every stock even has options available? is that right? I think Daily Journal is maybe an example of that.
Yeah. Daily Journal is a great example. So there's a few examples that I can bring up that might be useful for your viewers. So Berkshire. So first of all, our firm is only successful if we deliver outstanding performance over the long term. And so it doesn't make a lot of sense for us to sit around collecting single digit IRR premiums on a security. And really stable, strong businesses like a Berkshire Hathaway rarely will have the volatility and premium sufficient to use this strategy. You have to be pretty opportunistic. And we are opportunistic, by the way. So we were able to sell some puts on Berkshire during March of 2020. But typically, it wouldn't make sense. And you'd sort of sit back and you have to analyze, you know, at what point do I just buy the equity if I want to own it? And so to that point, you mentioned Daily Journal. Not all securities have these contracts. The contracts are basically created. There's market makers and Chicago Board of Exchange that that create these contracts and list them and make them available. And they are it's basically an algorithm that runs. And so if there's insufficient volume or the market cap's too small, there won't be contracts available. And even with a little bit of volume, there might be short-term contracts available, maybe up to 3 months or 6 months becomes available. It isn't until you get a little bit of a larger firm and maybe some larger volume where you start getting leaps that would go out a year or sometimes two or more years. And all of those are very different circumstances and very interesting. But if you find a really good opportunity, like a Daily Journal, we won't miss an opportunity just because they don't have options. It's just one way if there were options on Daily Journal, we'd be delighted. But there needs to be more volume for the Chicago Board of Exchange to list those contracts. And if they don't exist, it doesn't preclude us from owning the securities. We'll just buy them outright with a limit order, like everybody else does in the traditional sense. So so there are times when the premiums are insufficient to use them. There are times when there's no contracts available, and then there's times when you have really great opportunities as well.
Yeah, cool. And are there examples? I mean, what are the risks of a strategy like this? Is it, you know, you write put options on a stock you think's worth 200, and it's, you know, you write puts with a strike price of 100, for example, and then the stock just rockets to 400 or something? Is that kind of the risk? Or I guess on the other end, when you're selling calls and exiting the position, again, it just continues to run and you're out earlier than you maybe would have liked to be?
It's a great question. So there's two main negative scenarios. I sort of think of there being four situations.
Sure.
The first is that the analysis is wrong, the thesis is wrong. The company's actually going to 50 or 20 or zero. And that's the worst case scenario. Okay. So you sell a contract with a commitment to buy for 100, you get paid a $25 premium, and a year later the stock's selling for 50. That scenario, what you have to consider there is the sort of opportunity cost. The alternative is that you bought the equity for 100. So you either put in a limit order and buy it for 95 or something. So you either own the equity or you do this approach. So the worst scenario is the shares continue to decline. You realize the thesis was wrong. The value is not 200. The value is 50 or less. And now you have to unwind at a loss. If you're lucky, maybe you can sell a covered call and pick up a little premium. But the outcome in that scenario is that your net cash outflow is $75. And maybe you end up exiting at $50. So what you do is you've lost a third of that position. And that's, of course, terrible. As a permanent loss of capital, we want to avoid that at all costs. But those sort of situations can and do happen. But the alternative is that you bought it for 100 and you exit for 50. So you lose 33 using the structured value method versus 50 if you just mm-hmm. used a limit order and bought the equity outright. So That's the worst scenario. The second worst scenario, the one you alluded to, is that the analysis is absolutely correct and the shares triple. And while that occurs, you've sold some puts and maybe you capture your 33% premium, but you could have had a 200% gain or something over a small period of time, and you miss it. That scenario is painful for the portfolio manager and your PA. It might be painful for you a little bit personally, but it's certainly nowhere near as bad as the worst case scenario. This is a scenario where you make 33%. Nobody really complains. And there's surprisingly usually a new opportunity around the corner. So you can patiently wait for a little while and deploy that capital into a new opportunity. So, mm-hmm. But it is not fun. And there's some small ways to mitigate that we can talk about, in a moment. The third scenario, the third bucket is that the shares are slightly above the strike price. So you don't buy the stock and that's okay. So you make 33% and the shares go from, 100 to 110. So maybe the shares increase by 10%. We make 33%. And in that scenario, if we still think that's the most compelling opportunity for our capital, we could just turn around and sell more put contracts and do it all over again. So that's actually not that's a reasonable outcome. And then, of course, the best outcome is that it expires and the shares are at, $99 and you get put all the stock and it only costs you $75 and then it rockets up. You turn around and sell your covered calls and everything works really smoothly. And that happens a fair amount of fairly often, actually. So one thing I think it's a common theme in value investing is that we tend to see things pretty early. If you're doing your analysis properly and you're understanding how the world really works, it seems so strange that a company could be so mispriced. And then oftentimes it's shocking that, 12 months later, it's still pretty mispriced.
It keeps going down.
The cap hasn't quite closed. So this has actually been a very attractive way for me over time to say, here's a great opportunity. I'm not sure when the catalyst is coming. It's a good way to capture a bunch of IRR while we wait, and then hopefully get the shares and see them then rise. I'm happy to actually, if you'd like, I can share a little more detail because I've given you this very simple situation where we have sort of one strike price and we have one expiration date, but that's not actually the way that you would manage this in a portfolio. What we do is we really have a diverse portfolio of these contracts and we create sort of a matrix. So we would have expiration dates over time, And we would have different strike prices as well. So we'd write some that are in the money, some that are out the money, some that are out of the money. We'd write some that expire in 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, 1 year, 2 years. And then we sort of expect that we will buy some, miss others, and the total cost is going to be brought to a really low level because we're picking a premium on everything. And so if you have enough capital, it, you know, you can have a sizable PA that allows you to do this. You have to remember that every share is, every option is 100 shares. And even with a company like Berkshire, which has options on their B shares, you know, it's like you sell one contract, that means you have to put 28,000 into that roughly. Like, mm-hmm. I think the shares are around 280 or something.
Sounds about right. Yeah.
So, to start building out multiples, you know, expirations and strike prices and things quickly gets you into the many hundreds of thousands for a single position. But that's really the way, that we operate. So it's not a single strike and not a single mm-hmm. expiration, but a series that we build out and we buy some and we miss others.
Sure. And so with, you know, with the, I guess, underlying leverage you're getting with some of these options, how do you think about sizing? You gave the example there of buying, you know, one options contract on Berkshire gives you essentially close to $30,000 of exposure. So how do you, presumably these, yeah, I guess the premiums you're receiving are relatively small in the grand scheme of the portfolio, but if you get put the shares, kind of becomes a, I don't know what percent position, but 3, 5, 10% position. How do you think about sizing these things?
Yeah. So everything that we're looking at and the way that we're analyzing this is based on the notional value. So it's the cost of the security that we're looking at and, and these are cash secured. So we would like to buy them all. We're not writing contracts on things we don't want to own. And, that basically, the standard approach that we will use is, we will sort of move into something with a 2% position and then a 5% position. And then we'll take it to a 10% position. And that's our sort of rough guidelines on how we operate. If you're going to do something like this in, you need a fair amount of capital to be able to put this to work. Now, on the other flip side of this is that if you have too much capital, it doesn't work very well either because, the volume isn't there for these contracts. So, I don't know how many people realize this, but when Buffett was buying Burlington Northern, he was selling all the puts possible at the same time. He used to sell puts on Coca-Cola. And so this is something that, you know, even Buffett does. But when you have a huge amount of capital, maybe a few hundred million, if you're trying to put 30 million into a given position, there might not be the volume available. So it becomes a little bit more difficult to put this to work.
Mm. Yeah, I had heard that somewhere about Buffett selling puts on Burlington Northern specifically. Is that something he's written about or can you actually see that information somewhere?
That's a good question.
We'll, I might be putting it on the spot.
Maybe one of your viewers can figure out how I know that.
I think I've heard Phil Town say that exact same thing before, but I don't. Yeah,
that's
I don't
interesting.
Know where that came from.
I know it. I know it to be true, and I don't. Mm-hmm. And at one point, it's even in a slide that I've created for something. So I know that there's a source somewhere, but I don't know it off the top of my head.
Okay. But I'm sure somebody can let us know. Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's great. I think that gives a really good overview of the options strategy. I think someone put this question to you maybe in your annual meeting that I watched on YouTube, and it's, I apologize in advance because it's probably a impossible question to actually answer, but do you have any feel for how much this option strategy actually adds to performance over time? Or is it, is the fact that there's kind of four buckets, does that make it really difficult to actually put a hard number on that?
So what's interesting about this, when there's a position where we're able to use these puts well, I sort of think that it adds a solid single digit IRR to our performance over time. And and so, you know, 2 or 3% compounded over a decade makes a very big difference. And what that does is, you know, if we hold a position for 10 years and we're able to get in at a 20% discount to market price, and then on the exit sell for 20% premium to market price, that adds a significant amount to the total gain in the portfolio. But you know, a lot of times we're building into these and they're sort of like our infinite holding periods. So we have infinite holding periods with these securities. So it's difficult to say how much the premium that we receive selling puts on. I keep going back to Berkshire, for example, but, you know, we sold puts on Berkshire in 2011. We sold puts on Berkshire again in 2020. And some of them were put to us and we actually own an equity position, and some of them we just collect the premium. It really depends on how long we hold the security to know how much that premium really added to the IRR, annualized IRR. Sure. But it is a very significant advantage. And I mean, I encourage people, if it seems strange or doesn't seem clear, you can find a security you like and sell one and watch it play out over a year. And I think it will make sense to you after you experience it. So when we first launched the portfolio, this is why it's a hard question to answer also. There's a number of reasons it's difficult. When we first launched the portfolio and we only had cash, we were mostly writing puts. And so a lot of the gains were coming from the put premiums that we were receiving as the contracts were expiring. And as we started moving into our positions, the gains are, the balance shifts to the performance of the underlying equities. And so, you know, we've always had some new positions we're sort of building into. We have some outstanding puts today. But we still have an equity portfolio that's quite strong and growing well. So it changes over time, but it's a significant benefit to the overall portfolio.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. That's great. I think that, you know, like I say, gives a really good overview. I'd like to maybe shift into some individual companies that I know you've done some quite deep research on, if that's okay. One of the things I've found very interesting about your works, especially in Daily Journal Corporation, I was incredibly impressed with the level of digging that you were able to do to figure out stuff that is really, really difficult, or I mean, it's not possible, frankly, to see reading Daily Journal Corporation annual reports to figure out what these, you know, back-end cash flows from a SaaS business from Australia are going to be and all these things. And then, yeah, you know, these international stocks, and I think they've got holdings in BYD from memory. You might be able to tell me if there's any, yeah, others. But I guess maybe before we get into some of those specific companies, what does the research process typically look like for you when you're finding a new company? Or is this something that just varies widely depending on the business?
It varies. When you look at what actually lands in the portfolio, it varies really widely.
Yeah.
But there is a specific process that we follow. And the process, you know, a lot of people I think don't like to admit this or talk about this, but our process starts every quarter, or this is just happening kind of in the background now, but every quarter we do a very in-depth 13F analysis. So I have, and this began actually back when I was on Wall Street, because I didn't have the capacity to research thoroughly what I wanted to research. And I recognized that we could see, you know, we could have a kind of free look at what some other folks were doing. And so instead of just following one or two, we now follow about 100 different value managers. And every quarter, they have to throw up their 13 Fs. And I actually had, I had an intern write us some Python scripts that help us analyze this and really make it, it's really a wonderful output that we have now. And so the process starts there. What that does is that takes, let's say, 10,000 potential investment opportunities for us and narrows it down to about 500. And incidentally, before the crisis, it was about 300. And then it looks like everyone diversified a little bit because now it's 500. So that eliminates basically 95% of the entire market. And the most people try to approach this by screening. And I really don't think screening is very effective because what, you know, there's so many people screening and markets are mostly efficient. You need to find something very special within the firms. And it doesn't always, it's not always totally apparent on the financial statements as we can talk about with Daily Journal. So if we get interested in a business that isn't on this 13F, isn't on our 13F analysis superset, there has to be a very compelling reason why we understand why it's missing from this list. You know, you take, you know, 95 or 100 of the greatest value funds operating today, and how you know, and how could they possibly have missed the one thing that you found? Chances are that our analysis is incorrect in that scenario. So there's not a lot of reasons to move away from that. So we're trying to find needles in a haystack anyway. I think there's a lot of needles in this pile of firms. And and then as you get to know the managers and their styles, you get to understand, you know, where they excel and where they might have gaps in their own thinking, and it can help to eliminate other further mistakes. So Daily Journal really isn't on the 13F analysis list, but they actually have their own 13F. And but you know, it's run by Munger and this exceptional management team. So clearly it would fit, you know, within this circle. And so that's what first sort of led us to Daily Journal. What we do after the first thing we do is we just throw out companies that are too hard on this list. Some of it's through basic, you know, fundamental work where it just looks like there's red flags and we just eliminate them. And then other things are things that are just so far outside my circle of competence that we're not going to spend time there. But over time, it's a really nice list to study. So, you know, you don't need 100 managers if you have 5 or 10. I think you do a lot of the same work, Tom. It's like you're looking at these things and then you're studying these great companies. You're trying to figure out what's so, you know, why this manager would buy.
I released a 13F summary video about 8 hours ago. So you're speaking my language here.
Terrific. So that's where we start. And from there, we move into all sorts of fundamental analysis. And again, as I mentioned at the beginning, we're looking for exceptional business models, great management teams, and great value. And there's a lot of ways to sort of triangulate into that. But you know, if we want to talk about Daily Journal in particular, you know, it definitely satisfies all of those criteria. And one of the, I actually talked about this a while back also. I think at that presentation I called like hiding in plain sight, because there's all these great value managers that go and attend the Daily Journal meeting in LA every year. And, most of them are there to hear Munger's philosophy on life. And, you know, the questions range from, it's across the board. There's not a lot of talk about the Daily Journal at the Daily Journal annual meeting. And it's quite strange, as you mentioned, that people don't really, you know, haven't really picked up and and looked at it and started to own it, but the numbers don't look great. And the reason the numbers don't look great, as we can get into, is that there's all this off financial statement value. And that's when something becomes really compelling to us. It's like Peter Kaufman, who's on the board there, has this saying. He said, where there's mystery, there's margin. And there's so much mystery surrounding Daily Journal. And there's so much, there's a great opportunity there with Daily Journal. So where there's mystery, there's margin. The numbers on the financial statements are incorrect. There's off financial statement value. It does not screen well. It doesn't really show up on many 13Fs, but it has a 13F of its own. So it's quite an interesting situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is really interesting. The numbers have probably changed since I read your work probably a year ago now. But I mean, the stock portfolio of DJ Co was approaching the market cap, I think, at one point there. And then
yes,
you have right. Maybe talk us through the, as you say, the there's a lot of value that doesn't show up on the financial statement. So I guess the stock, the equity portfolio does, and we can see a lot of that in the 13F, but there's, you know, BYD outside of the US. And presumably a lot of the software business value is what is kind of black, what's missing from the financial statements, right?
That's right. So, so without, you know, going through, we have a couple of Daily Journal presentations that are on the YouTube channel. And at, we talked at the beginning of this beforehand that you've even done some work on Daily Journal yourself. And I think put out a podcast on it without going into all that detail, because that can just, people can go over and watch those. I will share at a high level a couple things that are going on and a couple of unique things that are happening right now that are going to make it even more confusing for folks. But so 4 or 5 years ago, Munger was sort of talking about this software at a very high level, and he'd maybe make a comment or two at the annual meeting that they're putting together software and it's probably not going to work. You know, 90-year-old men trying to build out some SaaS business. I don't even think they would call it SaaS. They just say some technology.
Yeah, it's quite funny. He says, this is very difficult. There's some pretty big competitors out there. It's not like Microsoft, where you make one bit of software and it can go to a billion people or whatever. It's a little more niche, right?
That's right. And actually, that's one of the bigger challenges with it, is that it's not true SaaS. This isn't Adobe. Okay. This is, there's unique characteristics that are required for every courthouse implementation. So this is a court case management software solution helps bring the courthouses to the modern digital age. And, Munger has a strong background in this space, in the legal space. And ultimately, what I found back in the day, just at a high level, it was so hard to understand what sort of software was being created. But I found a training conference that was happening in Utah. And I flew out. I couldn't get into the actual conference because I didn't have the right credentials, but I was able to fly out and just book a room. And I sat in the lobby and I interviewed all of the customers of Daily Journals for 3 days while they would take their breaks and have coffee. And I learned so much there at that meeting. Mostly I learned where to start looking. But I've learned one really important aspect, and that is how they go about their billing. And so what happens is, this is a bureaucratic space where you have governments bidding on contracts with a few key players, and there's an RFP process. And from basically RFP to go live can take anywhere from about 4 to 7 years, which is a very, very long time. But, you know, the first 12 months or so, I think in one presentation I put together a timeline, the first 12 months or so, it's just going through the RFP process. And then for those who have worked in technology, they sort of understand that then you have to establish a test environment and build out the servers. And then you have to replicate everything. And then you have to build this toolbox that they call e-suites. And then they have to figure out what tools they need to build inside of the box. And the difference, Tyler Technologies is their main competitor. And so what happens is, Tyler basically starts billing right away. So they get these 10-year contracts and they just start billing the courthouse. Daily Journal, because they've written a book on moats and they understand how to, you know, increase the IRRs and make things look really good for the courthouse, they don't bill anything until go live. And they don't even track an accounts receivable on their books. And so what that means is that anything coming down the pipe in the next 4 to 7 years is totally missing from their financial statements. And that is a very shocking realization. I don't think there's another firm that I'm not aware of another firm that is basically absorbing all costs of doing business and then just leaving all of the revenue off. And the way they justify it is by saying, you know, the courthouses and these municipalities, if they never approve the software, they don't have to pay. And, and so they're not tracking the revenue until it comes in the door. And so that left us with this new confusing picture of what the future was going to look like. So, so I started going through county by county. I brought in an intern to help me out, and we went county by county searching for city council meeting minutes and things. We realized it's missing from Daily Journal's balance sheet, but must be on the city's books and records somewhere that they owe Daily Journal. So we sort of inverted the problem. We went county by county. We did all these searches and we were looking for the software titles and names and all these keywords. And we located about 120 contracts that are in various stages of implementation and go live. And by finding these contracts, we're then able to figure out exactly how much revenue is coming in. And it's pretty clear to us that there's a, we think conservatively we'll reach about $100 million in revenue from the software side of things by the end of the decade. Tyler sells for 15 times revenue. I don't think that Daily Journal needs to sell for that type of multiple, but we have, you know, the market cap's maybe 450 million. It changes every day, but call it 450 million. They have a 300 million equity portfolio, leaves about 150 million bucks. So you get like this like crazy SaaS business that's operating this huge open space. It's probably going to just be an oligopoly, maybe a duopoly. And, but there's all these very small competitors out there because most courts have used their own homegrown system, their own technology, maybe at the state level, oftentimes at a local level. And ultimately they just won't be able to compete with a larger player. So Daily Journal is really well positioned to basically have like $1 billion+ software business, I think by the end of the decade. And the reason that this is so attractive, by the way, is that there's such asymmetry in this risk reward picture. So the equity portfolio, which now includes companies like Baba and has, you know, Wells Fargo and a few banks, you know, BYD, we have to look and reanalyze if they still hold that position or if they've made any adjustments there. But this is a core equity portfolio that's been built over the years by Charlie Munger. And it's worth, I think, 300+ million. The equity, the whole market cap's 450 million. They have a very unique debt profile that is mostly comprised of long-term capital gain tax liability, you know, zero interest rate, non-callable sort of debt. And ultimately the equity portfolio is going to reach the current market cap. So the downside in this investment is extraordinarily low. But if the equity port, if the software performs as we expect it to, I think we can be sitting on probably a $2 billion market cap firm, you know, this decade. And that type of IRR is phenomenal. So you get a phenomenal IRR on one side and you get like a non-negative IRR on the downside. So it's a, it's a really compelling opportunity. And there's no options available. So we didn't sell any puts to get in. We just bought the shares outright. And I'm very pleased, actually. Our little firm, you know, we're sort of approaching 20 million AUM, but our little firm now owns 0.5% of all the shares outstanding. So we own 0.5% of Daily Journal.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, it's a really interesting opportunity. It's fascinating to find those things that just don't appear in, like, that's never going to screen anywhere. So absolutely. You know, these are the absolutely opportunities that you can dig through, right?
When it starts screening, it might be time to sell.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I'd like to jump into some questions from YouTube and Twitter, if that's right, Matt. We've got quite a few of them to get through. So
okay. I'll try and be brief. We can do.
That is cool. Right. What have we got first? We've got quite a few questions on a couple of different stocks in particular. Just track down a good one here. So we've got quite a few around Seritage Growth Properties. I think this is a holding that you spoke about in your annual meeting, which is on YouTube, which is fantastic if anyone wants to go and check that out. And full disclosure for anyone listening, and I don't know if you know this or not, Matt, but I happen to be a shareholder in Seritage as well, so we may be slightly biased, but here's the question anyhow. So this is from Karan. Certain investors have mentioned that the story has changed with Andrea Olshan at the helm of Seritage and the numbers don't make sense anymore. How much value does Matt put on management for an asset-focused investment like Seritage, and does he think the story has changed with the new management team?
Okay, good question. I don't think the story's changed. I think that Andrea Olshan's going to do a great job. I actually had a call with Amanda Lombard, the CFO, just last Thursday. And I think what they're doing is quite compelling. You know, Ben Scholl was excellent. He just had other opportunities that came up. And I think it's quite exhausting. I mean, Seritage has been through the ringer. From, you know, Sears bankruptcy, and there was the whole commercial real estate collapse, and then we went through COVID. And I think it becomes quite exhausting to continue running a firm that's just getting pounded. Seritage is such a unique opportunity for us to deploy our structured value approach. So, look, there's two ways I think you can look at the Seritage properties. I think you can sort of look at the assets that are available in sort of a liquidation scenario. And you can also look at sort of the NOI and the future operating income from the properties once they're built out. And in both cases, I find it to be very compelling. In fact, I think very conservatively, I anticipate share prices being maybe around 35 or so and maybe in the 50s. At a high level, I will share that I have gone through every single property. They used to have 212. Now I think they have about 154, plus they have some JV assets. You can use tools like loop.net, but we've gone through and called local commercial real estate brokers and found, price per square foot for rentals, liquidation values, and put together the total value of every single property, one by one. In doing that, it gives us such great confidence to go out and sell puts, like at the money puts. I just looked earlier today because I think I saw the shares come down a little bit again. And I saw going out to, I think, January of 2023, and that's a whole nother unique story, kind of a funny story, but going out to January 2023, where there are currently options available, you can sell a 15 strike put and get like $3.50. And what that means is you could actually list a contract for four and just wait and be patient, maybe for a few weeks and probably pick that up. But even with $3.50, what that means, you have to hold $11.50, and we're talking like 14 months. So if you get $3.50 on $11.50, it's a 30% return. You know, 30% return in barely over a year. That's an outstanding situation if you truly understand the underlying assets of the business. So I actually think there's something that I think a lot of people have missed, and it's really new. So I'm not surprised that people haven't seen it yet, but there's this supplemental financial detail that came out at the very beginning of November. And the new management has made our lives so much easier by laying out the plan and purpose of every single property that they own. So they've gone from sort of this black box where we had to identify that this might be a good mixed-use property, and I think this one looks like it would be premier, and then they end up selling it, and then we have to adjust our models, to them actually laying out, these are going to be our multi-tenant retail. These are going to be our premier properties. These are the other properties, and other basically means we're going to sell these properties. So there is this supplemental financial presentation that's right on their website where they just list property by property and categorize everything. And it really makes life easy. So, I showed a few of our, valuations to Amanda, and she basically said, well, this one looks, way too high, but San Diego looks way too low. So, we don't expect to have exactly the right figures on every single one, but hopefully on average, we sort of balance out. It's a continuous effort. We just kind of keep working through them. They have $1.7 billion in debt, all allocated to or all provided by Berkshire. And they're probably going to go to a property level financing, which is actually going to reduce the cost of their debt. Right now, they're at 7%. So their interest expense is very high, but they're likely to start reducing that by refining individual properties, and they're going to end up with some positive cash flows coming here pretty soon, and then redeploying that cash flow to building out these properties. So it looks to us like they have about $4 billion in a value of their property, and you take out the 1.7 and sort of divide it by the shares outstanding, they have 160 million in cash. You do the math, and I think in the annual meeting, I even throw up a slide that does the math for you. And it looks like a pretty compelling return. And then when you throw on there the opportunity to write these puts at the money, maybe some in the money, maybe some out of the money, but you can pick up these sort of like 30% IRRs or over 14 months, 30%. It's an outstanding return. I mean, we're in a zero interest rate environment. Everybody's concerned about all sorts of different risks. And here you have an opportunity where the total liquidation value would be like $35 to $40 per share, and somebody's willing to give you $350 or $4 for a $15 strike price. So it's a very, very compelling opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fascinating. And I've been sort of Seritage continue to surprise me in how much they're able to sell some of these properties for, which are listed on the books at much lower valuations, which has been pretty impressive as well.
That's right.
How do you see the, so you mentioned the debt situation there, and let me know if you don't want to go into this level of detail, but how do you see the sort of debt transition happening at Seritage? Like, how quickly could they shift a $1.6 billion, I think, loan to Berkshire down to individual property debt? I think they have that loan coming due in 2023.
I think 2023 is right. So I actually asked a similar question in the meeting, and it depends on market factors and things. So even the rates are kind of unknown. It's like you can call up your local banker and figure out what the rates would be on some commercial real estate or mixed use sort of property. I would like to see it done sooner than later, because the interest expense will go down, and the interest expense is quite high. It's 7% on 1.6 billion really. And then I think they even pay like a 2% retainer on the 400 million that hasn't been released yet or something. So it's like a very onerous cost. So I think it's totally fair for them to be looking at refinancing opportunities. I think everyone would like to see it done quickly. And I don't know how long it will take. I can't tell you exactly how long it will take, but the sooner the better in my view.
Yeah. Agreed. here's a slightly different question. So this is from an account called Compounding 2020 on Twitter. And this is essentially asking about your experience doing the CFA charter. Would you recommend it? And what's the most effective method for learning the CFA material?
Great question. You know, there's a lot of people who have different opinions out there. My personal opinion is if it's interesting to you and you like studying the material, I highly recommend it. For me, it was highly valuable, but I enjoyed it. I wasn't doing it so I could get a promotion. I was doing it because I enjoy the material, and you get this massive breadth and depth of understanding of all different product types. A lot of it I don't use. Or when I do use it, it's very rare, but then you're able to pull from this background knowledge and understand things at a different level than somebody who hasn't gone through the program. You know, it's basically like a 3-year program. And, I would use the study guides. Like I would use Schweizer notes and things like that. I think I somewhere here have the books, I think down on the bottom shelf. So there's, you know, an enormous amount of textbooks and things, but the Schweizer notes were quite helpful for me. I took a class at one point, I think level 2, I took a class. So it just kind of, you know, I had a very intense day job and I needed to keep myself on track. So it helps to have even a virtual class that you sort of need to show up for on a weekly basis to keep you on track. But I highly recommend it. I think it's very valuable. I enjoyed, personally studying for it. I think it's it's an inexpensive way to gain the knowledge. And, so what are the pitfalls? Well, the pitfalls is that you're going to learn a lot of theory that doesn't necessarily work in practice. So that can work in both ways. You know the theory, and then you know what will actually work. So you might be able to use the theory to your advantage. So for example, when you take the exam, you're going to have to answer the questions as if the efficient market hypothesis is 100% correct. And then you might operate your life knowing that there's gaps in the market where the efficient market hypothesis is not correct. So that's sort of one of the challenges is, it's got to cater to this global audience. And so they're going to teach, Nobel Prize winning theories. And, you know, maybe they're mostly correct, but there's periods and times when they're not totally correct. So, that's some of the criticism of the material and exam. You do have to answer the way that they, if you want to pass, you have to give the answers that they want. But the material is, it's really well done. I think very highly of the designation holders. And in fact, there's, as you go through life, if you do have a designation, it's sort of like a little club. And when you meet someone and, you know, they have the 3 letters on their business cards or whatever, you're immediately sort of bound by the painful experience you went through as you prepare for these exams. So I do recommend it. Some people say it's a waste of time. I disagree. I think it's worth its weight in gold.
Mm-hmm. I like it. Cool. All right. We've got a question, another one from Twitter here from Nathan Price. How does Matt assess businesses and risk in Turkey given approximately 19% yields on government bonds?
Oh, great. That's a great question. So Turkey's a very interesting situation. And for those that don't know, I've had a Turkish focused fund for about 3 years. My wife grew up in Istanbul. And so right. I've spent a lot of my adult life over in Turkey and through this ValueX conference, I was introduced to Mesut Ali Otolu, who's the number one Turkish equity analyst globally. He was the chief investment officer of ABN AMRO for a bunch of years, and he wanted to partner up a few years ago. And I was reluctant for a little while, but ultimately we launched a fund, and the fund has. It's a very interesting place to operate and do business because all the rules of traditional finance in sort of developed efficient markets sort of fall apart, and you get back to Ben Graham, net opportunities. And Turkey's just a great place to go hunting for these situations. So interest rates are at 19%. So look, there are all sorts of dynamics in the Turkish market that are being poorly managed. All right. Mm-hmm. There's not many other ways around saying that it's really not managed very well. There are some actions that are taken that seem almost contrary to the intention. So yes, they have currency risk. Yes, they have political risk. Yes, they have high interest rates. The businesses that we like to see and find are businesses that are earning, a large portion of their income in sort of hard currency revenue. So euros and dollars and other strong currencies. And if there is any debt, you know, we'd like to have no debt, but if there is any debt, it's great if it's in lira, because the lira, it's just
continuously slowly disintegrating.
I would say disintegrating, and I would just remove the word slowly.
Okay.
We got married in Istanbul in 2011, and the lira was 1.3 lira per dollar. And I think today it's 10 lira per dollar. So that gives you a sense of how quickly the decline is taking place. And by the way, about maybe 12 years ago or 13 years ago, they eliminated six zeros from every bill. So they had $1 million Turkish lira bill, or sorry, 1 million lira bill, and they just turned it into one. So, you know, how do you get to a situation? They didn't start with $1 million lira bills. That's what they needed to be able to continue to make purchases and transact. So there's a continual decline in the lira. So we're not hedging currency. What we're doing is we're buying businesses that are making their revenue in hard currency that are trading on the Turkish stock exchange, and they end up selling for, you know, 3 or 4 times earnings, selling for less than book value, paying out 12% dividends, et cetera. When those re-rate, and it's not very, it's hard to find the catalyst, but the catalyst could easily be a new election. But when those re-rate, I think it happens overnight, and we just see, you know, doubles and triples in this market. So it's a hard market to be in. Our fund, Peterson Capital Management, has about a 5% position in the Turkish markets through this capital pipe that we've built, and so that's all allocated to these businesses over there in Turkey. Look, what can I say? We sort of ignore the interest rates. I mean, they factor into our analysis, but that's sort of a macro situation. We're really looking bottom up at these companies. And if anybody wants to know more, I'm happy to put people in touch with Mesut Eliotulu, who's truly extraordinary.
Great. Cool. And let's maybe do, one last question, because this is quite a big topic at the moment. We've got a couple of questions kind of getting at the sort of whole 10 cent NASPERS process kind of complex, which is kind of a confusing situation. But I think in your recent annual meeting, you said the fund maybe had a position in NASPERS. So how do you think about those three and why NASPERS, why not process, why not 10 cent directly? How do you think through that?
Yeah, you've done your homework. It's interesting because all these positions are popping up on a variety of portfolios, and I don't know who's first anymore, and it doesn't matter. But yeah. But people have taken these different positions. So look, I'll speak at a very high level about this, because this is one of our sort of infinite holdings. It's just like a really kind of incredibly it's a long-term compounder for us. Most people are probably vaguely familiar or familiar with Tencent. And the Tencent might be one of the best businesses in the world. I mean, it just with WeChat alone, you know, they have like a, I think almost a billion users, maybe 900 million users. I think they spend an average of 82 minutes a day in WeChat. And in WeChat, you can do anything from, you know, make payments and use fintech to do all the gaming, to all your social media. You can book doctor's appointments. I mean, it's across the board. You just you log into WeChat to for your daily activity, and so you know, you think like China has, you know, 1.3 billion people and, you know, maybe a billion global users now using WeChat, and people are awake like 16 hours a day and they're spending 82 of their minutes in WeChat. That's quite phenomenal. And the revenues are growing. I mean, and they have all sorts of revenue drivers, but the revenues are growing like 25-30%. And even that seems kind of sustainable for a while, which, you know, the TAM is enormous and the sort of terminal value, if you look out 5 years, it's going to be 5 years or even more. I mean, it's quite a large company. So all that becomes very interesting. Now the Naspers story, for those that are less familiar with Naspers, is Naspers just over, I think, 20 years ago, they took, what, 34 million maybe, and they bought, maybe they took 30 million, bought 34% of Tencent. And they've sold a little bit over time. But ultimately, Naspers has now grown with Tencent. It's basically become a look-through agent for Tencent. It's on the Johannesburg Exchange, and with a like 72 billion market cap, it's just breaking the Johannesburg Exchange. So ETFs can't operate properly. Wealth managers can't have restrictions about buying the ETFs because they get all this exposure to Naspers, and Naspers is the biggest company in South Africa. So they've taken all these steps. So that's created this massive gap between the value of Tencent, which I already think is like very, very inexpensive. I think a fair value for Tencent might be around $1 trillion, and it's growing. So this is not like some melting ice cube that's selling like a net Ben Graham where you're in and out. It's like you have a growing business. Naspers, needed to figure out something. And so what they did is they took all their e-commerce business, which included Tencent, and they spun it out into Prosus, and they listed it on the exchange in Amsterdam. So what happened is Naspers owns Prosus and Prosus owns Tencent. And so there's now a gap between Prosus and Tencent, the valuation. So, you know, and they both have like venture portfolios as well. So Prosus is trading at a discount to Tencent, and then Naspers is trading at a discount to Prosus. So now everybody gets in this debate, and the conclusion that I've made is that it's highly personal, and there's not necessarily a right answer. There might be a higher performing entity in 5 years. You can look back and say, oh, well, that was maybe the right one to own. But the question becomes, when will these gaps close? What level of risk are you willing to take? Do you want extra layers of management involved? Some people will argue you just go clean and you own Tencent. Okay. Others people will argue that you own Prosus because it can expand on the exchange and there's all sorts of opportunities where Prosus maybe has the opportunity to grow. But then Naspers that we own is at this further discount. So maybe that's just like the deep value nature of me. I just can't resist that this asset then sells for another 20% discount to Prosus. And I don't know when the gaps close or if they close. Okay, there's conglomerate discounts, you know, close-end funds trade at a discount. The gap does not need to necessarily close, but there is a little trick that I'll share with you and your viewers because it's helpful. Prosus and Naspers just recently engaged in this stock swap which was such a, they're again trying to close the gap, but what they're, because it's so confusing, they're actually making it more difficult to understand accidentally. So it's kind of a, it's unfortunate, but so they engage in a stock swap. And I don't know if this analogy is quite right, but what it looks like to me is one of these like circular references in Excel, where Excel just says like, this doesn't work anymore. So now we have NASPERS owns Prosys and Prosys owns Tencent, but NASPERS owns Prosys, but Prosys owns NASPERS. So for anybody who's looked at calculus or studied limits, it's like, If you keep pushing this loop, NASPERS owns Prosys, Prosys owns NASPERS, and you just push it out, it's like there's this, I think, asymptotic sort of approach. The limit is approaching this. This is my shortcut now, is that Prosys and NASPERS is a big pool of assets that combine own 28.9, I think, percent of Tencent. They have these venture positions around the world. And they're engaged in these various activities. The limit is approaching NASPERS owning 40% of the pool and Prosys owns 60% of the pool. And so now it becomes a lot more manageable to look at. And it's, and you can sort of analyze, you know, they own 28.9% of Tencent, and then Prosys owns 60%, and then Prosys has like a $40 billion plus dollar venture portfolio, but that's a combined asset now. So maybe Prosys gets 60% of that and NASPERS gets 40% of that. So that sort of helps, I think, understand the assets that are owned by these businesses. And we don't know when they'll close. We don't know if the gaps are closing, will close. Ultimately, there needs to be a structural improvement with the Johannesburg Exchange. There might be more spinoffs. There could be more buybacks. But management seems determined to find a way to close this gap. And so we're along for that ride. We like the Tencent asset, the assets inside of Tencent. And Prosys gives an opportunity for people to own that at a discount, and NASPERS gives an opportunity to own that at a further discount. And so we chose NASPERS, and it's, I think, just a personal decision that people make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a fascinating and confusing situation. I actually had, I think it was Karan who may have asked that first question about the new management at Seritage. I think he sent a tweet out yesterday, man, saying, how confusing would it get if Tencent started buying NASPERS as a cheap share buyback option or something?
Yeah, that's right. Or maybe Berkshire should just take all their cash and go and buy NASPERS.
Yeah, who knows? Yeah, it's a very interesting situation. I mean, that as I'm sort of only just getting started looking at this, but as I understand it, that discount's existed for a while, but I don't know that it's ever been this wide. And they seem to be as active as ever trying to kind of close the discount, right?
It's oscillated a bit, and it depends on sort of how you value every piece of the venture portfolio, and then what value you're using for Tencent. So if you're using the current market price, you know, it is quite wide. It's a very interesting special situation where this market, the systemic situation in the marketplace, has created this dynamic. And for those who are willing to sort of take on international positions, introduce a little different exposure to their portfolio, it's a pretty clear opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like it. Great. Well, it's been fantastic chatting with you, Matt. I think that's a good place to wrap it up. Really appreciate your time. And for anyone that's maybe not following along with what you're doing already, where can people go to see or hear more from you, or maybe get in contact with you if they'd like to?
I think go first start at our website. We have a ton of information on petersonfunds.com. And if you sign in or do anything, and I'll get an email and we'll start being in touch. We also have a YouTube channel where I've put up some of the presentations and material that we've been talking about. And that's mm-hmm. a great place to go and do further research. Both are great places to start, and it's not too hard to find my email address. So if you want to get in touch with me directly, I'd be happy to have a further conversation.
Great. And I'll leave the YouTube channel and website links and everything down in the description. If you're watching this on YouTube, or if you happen to be listening on a podcast platform, that will be in the show notes. But Matt, this was good fun. We'll have to do this again sometime. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Tom. It was great.
Right, cheers. See ya.